from the Book Corner in Saltburn's new location. It's the Book of the Month, live.
And this month's book is A Robot in the Garden by Deborah Instal. A Robot in the Garden is Deborah Instal's debut novel. It is a humorous story of friendship set in a slightly alternative modern-day world, or possibly in the not-so-distant future. The story is told from the point of view of Ben, a self-deprecating, unemployed 34-year-old. Ben is married to Amy, a successful lawyer. The novel opens with the couple finding a robot in their garden. Amy has no interest in the robot and wants to send it to the scrap heap, but Ben takes pity on it and allows it into their home. The robot is called Tang, and he can talk, although at first the conversations are rather laboured. It soon becomes clear to Ben that Tang is lost. He's also broken, but he can't, or won't, tell Ben where he came from or how he can be fixed. Ben decides to solve the mystery of Tang's origins. Meanwhile, his marriage is in trouble. Amy thinks Ben is incapable of following anything through, and his lack of a job is a source of tension between them. Ben's preoccupation with Tang is the last straw for Amy, who leaves.
It was the middle of the night when we landed in San Francisco. When I booked the flight, I hadn't considered the time difference, nor that autumn nights could be chilly in California, even if the days were still warm. Shuffling through the arrivals hall, I wished I'd worn a jumper, jeans and some thick socks, not canvas shoes and a cotton shirt and slacks. We stood at the carousel waiting for my shiny new backpack to appear through the rubber curtains and glide its way towards me. I suddenly remembered the missed call from Bryony. I frowned, then set the phone to do not disturb and shoved it back in my pocket. I considered switching it off altogether, but at least this way I could still use the internet. Tang sat on the carousel ledge, despite my protestations, and trailed his grabber along the conveyor belt. He had to pick it up and move every few seconds before he got swept along. Eventually, I went and hauled him back to a safe distance away from the carousel. I did not want to have to go to Lost Property at 3 a.m. after a long-haul flight and explain that I'd lost my robot because he wouldn't be told no. When at last it circled towards my feet, my backpack was heavier than I remembered. The tiredness had dulled my initial exuberance about the trip somewhat, and the best thing we could do was hire a car and get to a hotel. Incredibly, all the car hire places were closed. An international airport, and one couldn't hire a car in the middle of the night. I didn't consider getting in a cab instead. "Come on, Tang. We're catching the bus." "Bus?" "Yes, this way." I strode off in the direction of the sign, leaving Tang to clank after me as fast as his tumble dryer hoses would carry him. Formless shadows shuffled around in the dim, artificial light of the bus station, and every now and again a broken door on one of the tall lockers that lined the wall banged open and slammed closed again. A tramp in a stained overcoat sat in a corner, eyeing my new backpack. One solitary android ticket attendant sat behind bulletproof glass in a tiny booth. He was wearing a flak jacket. You know it's a bad place if an android needs protection. They often get assigned jobs like this, somewhere a human doesn't really want to work, but which needs something a bit more than a straightforward machine. For some reason, it was important to me not to lose face in front of Tang, so I attempted to maintain a breezy composure and walked straight up to the booth, leaving Tang to follow in his own time. "Excuse me, do you know of this corporation?" I held up my phone, upon which I'd stored the name of the company I thought I'd found on Tang's underside. "Sir, please keep your cell out of view," the android said flatly. I glanced about me and understood. Even the sound of my voice had drawn attention to us from one or two of the nearest shadows, and holding up a shiny phone was just an invitation. I put it away in an inside pocket. By this point, Tang had caught up with me. He grasped my shirt sleeve and held on tightly. I told the droid the name of the company again, and this time he was more responsive. "Yes, sir, it is in my databanks," Micron Systems, makers of the latest in humanoid home assistance technology, a Fortune 500 company, winners of the Technology in Action Award for 3 consecutive years, chief executive Mr. I get it, I said, and tried a different tack. Thank you for the information, but what I really need to know is how to get there. I am programmed with a variety of local knowledge ready to serve your needs. He shot me a smile. Well? I'm afraid I don't understand, sir. Can you tell me what you mean by well? I'm waiting for you to answer my question about Micron Systems. Which question, sir? About how to get there. Sir, an assessment of our conversation suggests that you have not yet asked a question about the location of Micron Systems.
21.99, please.
Ben resolves to prove to himself and Amy that he's capable of decisive action. Having learned that Tang was possibly made in California, Ben flies out there, taking his robot friend with him. Together they embark on a road trip with the aim of getting Tang mended. Their travels take them from California to Texas to Tokyo, encountering everything from a rather suspect hotel for humans and their androids to a ghost town inhabited by a radioactive sausage doll.
The next day, Tang and I rode the elevator up what seemed like 100 or more floors to Kato's office, another glass building like Corey's place of work in California, apparently de rigueur in the AI industry. That we were even there was some sort of miracle, since in Tokyo, of all places, it was a 1,000,000-to-1 chance that we'd be in the same bar. But it turned out that his office wasn't far away, and the bar was his local. Like I said, 1,000,000-to-1. I can't remember much of the conversation from the previous night, but Kato tells me I swore at him, then asked why he hadn't replied to my email. Then he told me he had replied to my email, I just hadn't seen it. He said he'd asked me to bring Tang to see him the next day at 11, so he could take a closer look at him. Then he gave me his card. He told me to keep the appointment because at present my mind wasn't on the questions I wanted to ask, and anyway it was too dark to see Tang properly in the bar. This wasn't the last time Kato was so gracious. The elevator made a woof, woof noise as it travelled, which was just at the right pitch to make my stomach turn and my hungover head pulsate. One side was glass too, and Tang took great delight in pressing his cheek to it and calling out, "Whee!" as the heaving street dropped away from us. I, on the other hand, couldn't bear to look. "Tang, please be quiet, mate. My head hurts." Tang looked at me, swiveled his head back to the view, and carried on. I rubbed my forehead and took shallow breaths. The elevator dinged our arrival at floor 53, and we emerged onto a corridor running to either side. Before we had a chance to wonder which way to go, however, a door opened a little way up to the left and Kato's head appeared. "Mr. Chambers, please come on down." He gave us a big, warm smile, and I felt even worse about my behaviour the previous night. "Mr. Aubergine-san," I began, attempting Japanese nomenclature etiquette. "Please let me offer you my humblest apologies for the state in which you found me last night. I'm not usually... well, that's not how I am normally." I put my hands together and bowed, because I'd seen someone in a Japanese film apologising this way. Then I hoped I wasn't being inadvertently offensive in any manner, but Kato smiled and proffered me his hands to shake. "Please, I spent a lot of time in America, and I have seen a lot of English people come to Tokyo. I have seen jet lag before. And please... call me Kato. You are very kind." I was genuinely moved by the honourable way he was treating me. "Please do call me Ben."
The novel is part science fiction, part coming-of-age story, and part road novel, to borrow a term from the movies. The world Deborah Instal creates is recognisable as our own, with one important difference. Artificial intelligence is more advanced and more widely available. Androids can be purchased in much the same way as any other household appliance and perform the functions of domestic servants. The robotic elements are an integral part of this world, but Instal introduces them unobtrusively, only going into as much detail as is strictly necessary to make her world seem real. This gives the novel strong crossover potential, as the reader doesn't need to be a science fiction fan to appreciate it. The novel is very funny in parts, with much of the humour coming from Ben and Tang's roles as mismatched travelling companions. Unlike the shiny androids, Tang is a robot full of character. He's very willful and has a mind of his own. He insists on booking premium seats on the flight to California and gets into a sulk when Ben won't let him use his new umbrella indoors. At its heart, A Robot in the Garden is a novel about friendship, about relationships, and about growing up. At the start of the novel, Ben is very much stuck. We learn early in the story that his parents died in an accident several years earlier, and this has left him rudderless. He is also afraid of responsibility, fearing that he'll fail at anything he tries. Through his friendship with Tang, he learns what it is to be needed, and that he's capable of looking after another person, or in this case, robot. Funny, tender, and full of warmth, A Robot in the Garden is a lovely debut, which will appeal to fans of David Nichols and Matt Haig.
And so we're back in a new location journey for this Saltburn-based Book of the Month on location. Would you like to share exactly where we are again, in case the listener's just forgotten exactly where we were based?
We are in Jenna Warren's new Book Corner bookshop. No longer the smallest stationery bookshop in Britain, but as she said, you have to move on sometimes.
It's a bigger Warren than before.
It's a bigger Warren than before, and this is a special Book of the Month with the script written by Jenna on one of her favourite books to celebrate.
Round of applause for Jenna Warren and a superb script.
Thank you.
So, Jenna, I believe this was your choice of text to actually analyse. Why?
Well, I read it when it first came out and I just really loved it. I like these sort of quirky novels which have a bit of a crossover between genres. So I like a novel to be funny, but I also like it to have a sort of slightly off-the-wall element to it. So I really like the idea of somebody going on this road trip with the robot. I think the thing which really sold me was when I read an early sort of summary of it before it came out, and it mentioned the word radioactive sausage dog. Yeah. I'm not quite sure why that sold the novel to me. But I thought, this is going to be one for me, I think. It's going to be sort of off the wall and quite funny, and hopefully nothing bad will happen to the sausage dog. But, we'll wait and see.
Okay, and Rob, a first time for you, having looked at the novel, having read through Deborah Instal's book. Thoughts?
I really loved it. It was really, really good. From the first line was that there's a robot in the garden. It's just it's a great start, isn't it, to the book. And then you wonder... You quickly wonder if a robot's normal in this. Is this like a sci-fi book, or is it, and then you get drawn into the story, the relationship between the robot and whether it's ever going to talk, whether it's ever going to function or do anything. And then the robot's very much like quickly apparent. The robot's very much like a child, and it's like a precocious child, and then you're going on this trip across the world. And with this precocious child acting up all the time. And, it's fantastic.
I guess around about 95 years ago when Joseph Chapek coined the term robot, and then his brother Carol Chapek wrote R.U.R., Rossum's Universal Robots, to bring the term into the language as a kind of slave worker and an operative that was constantly there. So they're a phenomenon of the 20th century, and Rob, I suspect you're a similar chronological age to myself that remembers the joys of Warning, Danger, Will Robinson, and Lost in Space, and Robots, and that thing, and Robbie the Robot.
A children's programme called Robert's Robots.
There was indeed, yes, which is again a play on the whole system. So what is it about robots that actually appeals to us? Jenna, you talked about you liked Radioactive Shot Sausage Dog.
Yeah.
We've got films like Short Circuit, Number 5 is Alive, recently we've had Chappie, we've had Friendly Robots, we've got obviously the C-3PO R2-D2 characters. Well, I mean, I don't see any robots in the book corner.
Well, I have to say, I'm not a huge sort of robot fan in general, but I do like the fact that I sort of like stories which explore what it is that make us human. Mm. And I think when you, for example, if you watch a film like I, Robot, for example, that sort of explores like what would make a robot sentient? Does it have free will? And I find that sort of thing really interesting. So it's not really the sort of technology element I find interesting. It's sort of it's the characterisation and what makes Tang human. I think if it had just been a robot that was sort of clanking along and, you know, doing what it was told, like the androids basically represent that in the book, it wouldn't have had the same appeal. But Tang's a real character, and I think that's why I enjoyed it.
I think Asimov would be proud that his three laws of robotics are still in action and that iRobot is still getting mentioned these days. Jenny, the robot as a synonym for the alien, we talked about, you ended up the piece, or Jenna ended up the script today, with this novel would appeal to fans of Matt Haig, and obviously the humans, he kind of does the same thing, but using aliens and extraterrestrials. Which, do you have a preference for robots, extraterrestrials? Because clearly the robot is, in many ways, a human-made creation.
Well, yes, the robot, in a lot of ways, reflects ourselves back at us. And I think that's why they are so fascinating. We like to think that we are the great creators. And we can't even in our imagination create a robot that is like a human and as complex as a human. And I think that's part of the endless fascination. Aliens are very hard to actually write properly because they have to be totally alien, and it's almost impossible to write something. Well, it is impossible to write something alien enough that you can't imagine it. Mm. It's a contradiction in terms. And so all our aliens are also reflections of ourselves, but we try and make them strange. Whereas robots, this robot Tang is the strongest character in the book, I think. And he's lovely. I wouldn't take him home. He's a disaster, but he's fascinating to read about. He's great.
We've spoken about the robot, and clearly he takes centre stage, but let's talk a bit about Ben, because there was a part of me which thought, yeah, okay, I sort of can identify with him after a fashion. But then actually, you have to say, he was extremely fortunate, as described, in being effectively the beneficiary of two fairly significantly wealthy parents, so it seems as though they weren't exactly worrying where the next $5,000 was coming from. And obviously he stumbled into a marriage. I almost felt as though we were channeling the spirit of a kind of Hugh Grant, Richard Curtis character here. I don't know, Rob, what did you think? Maybe it's just I was perhaps looking for a bit more realism in that sort of sense, really. But your thoughts on Ben? Did you think he was okay, or did you sort of want to hit him at times?
No, he was obviously, when you're first introduced to him, you see you're not very sympathetic to him compared to his wife. That you can see her side of it, everything. But as it goes through the story, it's quite good because you do see him develop and become more of a sort of rounded person. Mm. And but I was struck with something else about the robot. This is the first thing. I think it's the first time I've read a book. I've seen a book about robotics where the robots aren't a threat to humankind. That it's a sort of sympathetic. In fact, you're feeling sorry for robots quite often in the book, the way they're being treated. So yeah, there's no sort of feeling that the robot that this robot is like a sentient being. It can develop itself. There's no feeling any stage in the book that it's a threat to everybody.
Mm. Jenna, did you feel this? I mean, you talked about androids, and at least in Channel 4 series, humans obviously deals with those. Androids is another staple of science fiction. Robots that look like us, that have human form. The description that Innistor provides for Tang is a very, very crude robot. It's almost echoing the kind of robotic lion that, and I know that she's going to go off and actually deal with another customer now, so we'll do that.
Sorry.
We should have actually mentioned earlier in the production, I think during the readings, we had another keen person who's actually coming to the bit store, because that's what we're doing. We're running this thing as it happens, live.
Live in a bookshop.
Live in a bookshop, with lots of sort of dialogue crossing over. It's like an episode of Hill Street Blues with robots. Jenny, put the question to yourself then, in terms of that possession of robots and the position
thank you very much.
And the very, very crude description that we actually have, because literally that's the kind of machine that you would expect a 3 or 4 year old child to draw if you were actually giving them a robot.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's very simple. It has all the bits, the head and the arms and the feet in the right place. But it's extremely simplistic. The thing about androids is that they are supposed to be partly made of flesh. So they're half and half to become an android or a cyborg, whereas a robot is entirely mechanical. And there's no reason why we should go back to all the fragile, stupid bits of the human body that really don't work very well, like knees.
Yeah. You
know, it's a fascinating design, but why put them in a load-bearing position like that? It surely makes sense to have a three-year-old child's robot that hasn't got these vulnerabilities.
Mm. In terms of the evil genius that we're presented with, the literally deus ex machina, in essence, that creates and is the creator of Tang and his almost diabolical scheme for the whole sequence. Did that work well, Rob, or would you actually sort of prefer to have more of the interaction? Because he kind of builds to this climax, which could almost have been taken from, I don't know, maybe like Spy Kids or various other things, but this sort of notion of, you know, almost the classic Bondian line of the island and the whole sort of sequence. How well did you feel that Instil was at articulating that, you know, the nasty person, if you like, the person who was just who basically saw Tang as a toaster?
Yeah. Well, we're building towards that through the book, aren't we? We've got to have a twist, haven't we, at the end? And we've got to. I don't want to give away anything you're building to, but no, I thought it was good. It was
spoilers, Rob.
Yeah, I know.
Please,
that's unlike you, isn't it? Yeah, we're building the drama towards the end, aren't we?
But the robot doesn't die. That's all I'll say.
Well, can it die? Can the robot die? That's that. Obviously, there's questions on that as well, isn't there, in this book? But no, that worked for me. And I liked a lot of the characters that we were introduced to on the way. And I suppose the fact that they all were supposedly working in artificial intelligence, they weren't nerdy people, I don't think. Maybe until we get to the end.
Well, I think it's an interesting sort of way, because clearly the locations that we're presented with, we go to, in essence, Silicon Valley, or the approach around there, and obviously off to Tokyo. So you're looking at kind of two of the key areas within that. I mean, Rob, of course, you've got, a brother who's over in Tokyo, or no, Hong Kong.
He lived in Tokyo for many years.
And Jenny, you've got Hong Kong connections as well for the point of view. So lots of technology that's actually there. Did it resonate? Did you think she got it right? Because I don't know, I wasn't hugely convinced by some of the overseas descriptions.
Yeah, I think it was a very limited description of Tokyo, because they were basically in the hotel and a bar and that was it. Although that's all a lot of people see in Tokyo, apparently.
Yeah.
It's impossible to get around because there aren't any street numbers or names. Very helpful.
That's right.
The island seemed to me almost a parody of the island of Dr. Moreau. That's what struck me, with the new Dr. Moreau sitting in the middle of it. It was a child's tropical island. But I thought the America bit was much better. That resonated much more. And I thought the Android Hotel was hilarious and very, very creepy.
There is that technology street in Tokyo. It's somewhere that people visit. Where you go. When I was there back in early 2000s, you could go and see the latest phones that were 10 years ahead of ours and video cameras and stuff that we didn't have for years, and just go and marvel around all the shops. So that is quite sort of, that's always been really big in Tokyo.
Two characters we really haven't touched upon as yet, but probably do need to be covered, are the roles of Amy and, of course, Roger, who kind of moves from being a gentleman who's seen as like a number one person to a complete, shall we say, socially challenged individual in all sorts of ways. I mean, Jenny, how did you feel that those descriptions went in terms of, or did you warm to any of them? And did you see Amy kind of going through her own journey? Because we're talking about a road trip. The whole essence of a road trip, the genre of road trip novels, is that our characters effectively go through a process of change and self-discovery.
Yeah, I think Amy does. It's just that we don't see most of her road trip. I felt a bit sorry for Roger because he was there to be the sort of paper stalking horse, really. He was there, he was good, he took Amy away, he was bad. Then in the end he was yeah, well, spoilers. Hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. Definitely a paper man. And I thought he was a character that really didn't work that much. Mm. And to a certain extent, that reflected on Amy, who actually fell for this lummox. You think less of Amy because of him, which is a shame, because she obviously put up with a lot.
And a complete 180-degree turn from Amy in terms of her reaction to Tang. Yes. Initial reaction to actually becoming indispensable.
Yeah.
Actually, the key person who actually helped her through her pregnancy. Yes. So a whole range of actors from that. The nature of humanity, the nature of immortality, the growth of human beings, the notion of robots as reflecting ourselves. Maybe Pinocchio also went through a different sort of characterization. And we wouldn't be doing our duty, I don't feel, if we didn't mention Super Toys Last All Summer Long, of which the movie AI was based, because, again, that certainly, I think, might have provided Deborah Install with some of the thoughts about the robotic gigolos and activities that we get in terms of the line for that. But all good things must come to an exit port, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So let's move to Jenna. What did you actually feel the book is worth in terms of scores? What are you going to give it?
I would give it a 9.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just in terms of there were points. I mean, I think it's brilliant.
Obviously not brilliant enough to get a 10 out
but
of 10.
There are a couple of points where maybe I would have preferred a little bit more detail, but that's just me, I think.
Okay. Rob?
I'm going for a 9 out of 10 as well.
9?
Good
okay.
book.
Yeah. Jenny?
I think it's a cracking debut, but I'm going to give it 8 out of 10 because I was very disappointed with the way the villain just fizzled out. I wanted more of that. I don't think he'd have let Tang go like that.
And that's what I'm equally going for, an 8 out of 10, actually. So it's 2 nines, 2 eights, which is a very solid launch, bringing in mind it's her first novel, I think.
Absolutely.
Well done from that perspective. But we talked in this particular production about the alien, and I do believe that you've actually got something which ties up for the April book of the month, our Easter special, which focuses on the alien. Jenny, would you like to reveal all?
Yes, our April book of the month will be Sherry S. Tepper's masterpiece, Grass, where for the first time, I believe, somebody wrote an alien that cannot be imagined.
Mm-hmm. In association with Pharma Non-Nutritional Supplements, you've been listening to the Book of the Month live from the Book Corner in Saltburn, and the full address, if people wish to actually sort of see where the Book of the Month was recorded, is, Jenna?
It's 24 Milton Street, Saltburn.